Hello, I'm Michael Barr.
And I'm Scott Soschnick. Every week at this time, plus Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, we explore the big money issues in the world of sports.
On this week's show, we have Carlos Rodriguez, owner and CEO of European esports team G2. But first, let's look at the top stories of the week. Joining us is Bloomberg Business of Sports reporter Evan W. Williams. I want to start with the NBA. Now they're saying that fans can purchase the fourth quarter of any NBA game on League Pass.
Yeah, we've been hearing about this for some time. This is not a surprise. This is one of those, oh, they finally got around to announcing this. They're doing it. They were testing micro-buys in-app. That's what this is about. Do you want to sample a piece of a game? I think the NBA knows that some people just kind of like the last 5 minutes of the fourth quarter or the fourth quarter. Or in the betting world now, Michael, you may have heard that betting may come to many states.
What?
Yeah, if it's a tight game or, you know, it's right on the line, somebody may want to tune in and see. This is just a natural extension of the digital sports viewing world and things that are coming. And another revenue stream for the NBA.
Of the four leagues, the NBA certainly has done the best so far in breaking down its digital media rights in an a la carte way. For a while now, I think three seasons, you've been able to buy a single game for $7. All of their league packages also have monthly deals. This is certainly the smallest, $2 for a fourth quarter. As Scott said, micro purchases. It exists in video games right now. It's all over. Trying to get people to part with their money in smaller ways, more frequently, and fourth quarter is certainly something that the NBA fans might do.
And Barr, it's very funny. You know how we talk about OTT? That's all the rage these days. OTT, direct to consumer.
Right.
When you think about it, League Pass was the first OTT. That's in essence what it is. That's a direct to consumer service that's been around a really long time. So it's no surprise that the NBA is in here first.
I got to bring up a quote from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver. He says that we imagine a situation where a fan has dinner at 8 o'clock and only has about 30 minutes and can choose to buy a half hour of a game. Now, I get it. That's nice. But I'm from the school.
Here comes Barr.
I know. Here I go. It's like there's a reason why there are four quarters in the NBA. And there's a reason why there are 500 miles in a race. I get it, but I want to see the whole game.
Are there 500 miles
race
in the Brickyard 400?
You know what I mean.
Thank you.
But if you want to see the whole game, you can pay $7 and you can see it. For the people that only want to watch the fourth quarter, which is me if I want to watch basketball at all, the fourth quarter might be enough for
Dang,
me.
Man. If I want to watch basketball at all, man, it's like basketball. I will say it and say it again. Basketball to me is out of the four major food groups of the sports is the best, and because it's short and concise, about over a little over 2 hours. So, moving right along, let's talk about companies around the world. They're going to spend $65.8 billion on sponsorship deals this year, but how many of these businesses know if it actually works or not?
Yeah, that's the role. And I've been asking this for a long time. Every time I deal with folks who sponsor and they're spending big dollars, whether it's naming rights, and now, of course, they're usually way more intricate than that, I always ask them, and it's interesting to hear the responses, how do you measure the return on investment? How do you know whether you're getting your money's worth? And some don't always have good answers. They figure they do. They're trying new analytics. But according to MKTG here, obviously a lot can't really say whether they're getting their money's worth.
I don't think I've ever really had a sponsor that was able to fully break down ROI on an advertising deal. And I think it might be one of the reasons why you're seeing advertising deals change. You know, in the past couple of weeks, I've written about State Farm's new deal, naming rights deals for stadiums and arenas, and MasterCard's new esports deal. And both of them essentially said that the traditional ad model where you're paying either for traditional commercial time or to put your sign somewhere is going out of fashion. And a large part of that is for this reason, that it's very difficult to assess how effective that is in either driving your brand out there in terms of brand awareness or acquiring customers directly.
You know why I think that it works very well for a sport like hockey? Because you put the brand, let's say you put PNC Bank on the sidewall of the rink.
Yeah.
and the cameras going on. And it's unlike the NBA where the sponsorship changes because of their the way they have it going. It has to stay there. It's stationary.
Well, you ready? I'm going to bring up Jackson because I got to bring my son in. You know what I loved last night? I swear this happened. 9 years old, we're watching the Rangers and the Islanders preseason game from Madison Square Garden last night, and the camera panned, and one of the Dasher board advertisers is Dunkin' Donuts, who, as we know, is changing the name, and it had the DD. Yeah. He goes, "Hey, Dad, are they going to take away one of those Ds?"
Good question.
Right. 9 years old.
And he knew it.
My boy.
And those were some of our topics for this week's show. Now let's get into Scott Ebben and my interview with the guest we have this week, Carlos Rodriguez. He is the founder and CEO of esports team G2. Carlos is a retired mid laner known for playing SK Gaming.
Carlos, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. I love being here.
We've been doing this show for over a year now, I think. You're the first esports-specific guest that we've had. So for our audience who doesn't fully know esports, certainly not as well as you, G2, is that the Real Madrid of European esports? Is that a fair comparison?
People actually sort of compare us to Real Madrid very, very often. Esports, which is video game competition, we've been here for a long time, and people sort of understand and know who's behind G2 Esports and all the management, the players, all are known figures within our industry. People sort of connect us to Real Madrid very often, which I don't dislike because I've been historically a Real Madrid fan.
Are you Ronaldo?
I'm more Ronaldo fan than a Real Madrid fan even.
Are you Juventus fan? Is that?
I'm Juventus fan, yeah, exactly.
When did you start playing? How does that happen?
Yeah, so it's not like from one day to another, right? But, I was very young. I always, competed in traditional sports. I competed in soccer. I played for Atletico Madrid, by the way, which, by the way, I have a good story. First day doing the tests for Atletico Madrid, which is like the rival of Real Madrid from back in the days. And the first thing the coach says, which nowadays would be impossible, but the first thing he says is, "Who's a Real Madrid fan from here?" And a few kids raise their hands.
They can't be the smart kids who raise their hands.
They got kicked. They got kicked from the test.
There you go.
And there I realized that I would do everything for success because I did not raise my hand. I'm the worst fan ever, So I kept playing and I kept it as a secret. And that's, it's a funny little story.
You were smart.
Yeah, no, that's how it goes. And I was 11 years of age approximately. And my dad comes from work and he's like, I know this game. I'm going to play with my friends and blah, blah. So it was called Half-Life, which is essentially what Counter-Strike, which is one of the largest esports today, turned into. And he started playing, with their friends, with his friends for a few weeks. And one day he had to go to the restroom. I was always watching him play. And he would let me play for like 2 minutes or 3 minutes when he went to the restroom. And in those 3 minutes, like, I did really well, apparently. And his friends, he was communicating with in ICQ.
Did they have any idea it was you playing?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you stepped into
them,
your... Okay.
He told them, "Hey, guys, it's my son.
Take it easy on him."
Well, he returned and they said, "Why don't you go do the homework of your son, and your son stays here with us because he's kicking ass."
From years ago, it's like, when my kid, he's 13, and my kid, he would be on the video game, and I'm like, "All right, now you got to do your homework." And then as it progressed, how much money can be made in esports, and I see that he's pretty good at Fortnite, I'm like, "You go ahead, John.
There you go.
Go ahead and play, buddy."
I mean, it's so nice to see, when I was trying to convince my parents that this was a good idea, it was a no-go. It was just there's no way it was going to be a good idea for them. So, it was really slow, right? Right now, it's very easy to, in hindsight, look back and say, yeah, it was a good idea that we let him do that. But it was really tough. You're not used to see video game competition bringing any money to anybody. All you see is these people that have troubles and problems or whatever, which is not the truth, really. It's like a mythology. I thank my parents for having kind of that forward-thinking attitude and let me do, what my dream ended up becoming. But today, you look right now at the industry and you see so much money involved and so much opportunity, not only just to be a player, but also to create, video content, to live stream, to be even photographers make good money nowadays in esports, which wasn't the case before, of course.
For American football, way back when the NFL was just starting, it was common to see players become owners. It was kind of the next step, which is what you did. You were a very successful player. You became owner G2. Is esports now past the point where that's a transition that happens easily. I mean, it's not happening in football anymore. It's not happening in any other big sports. Are you kind of the last of the players that kind of ease into ownership and kind of take off in the rocket ship from there?
I wonder, how much did you pay to get in, though? What did you pay for ownership to get in?
Yeah, that's a good point. So over the course of 4 years, we more or less raised all, I can't say the exact number, but all the way from 3 to 6 million capital, which is not a lot for the position we're in at the moment. We're a top team at the moment. If you want to do, if we want to replicate what we did in the past 4 years today, that is going to cost you probably 40, 50 million minimum. So I recognize the lack, you know, of in terms of timing. Timing is a big topic here. You know, when I got started, things were much cheaper. Things were more a bit, you know, the Wild West. So, you know, if you were somebody ambitious, you could many ways get away with poaching players and things of that nature. And that's what we did. You know, there were no rules. So why not, right? And yeah, so during those 4 years, even though there were significant resources invested into it, you know, and a lot of ups and downs, the industry has developed incredibly much. And now we're at a point where players can, I don't think, any longer essentially form their team because the barrier of entry is just so high. It's just really tough. You can't just, you know, as a former player, create something from zero.
How does the entire ecosystem change when it's institutional money that's involved? It's not, as you said, sort of the single one-off person able to do it anymore.
Oh, it's a positive development because the access to talent becomes, talent becomes more accessible. So that means that revenue generation grows faster than it would have otherwise. Production quality of events and even just in-house production becomes better because people from other industries that bring their know-how and experience essentially upgrade the quality, the overall quality of the industry. So overall, it's a really good thing. And what I've come to realize during those 4 years, and I mean, I've been here for now 15 years as a player and now team owner, is that esports has something really valuable, or video games in general has something really valuable, that unlike in traditional sports where, NFL may be decelerating, right? But at the end of the NFL, you know it'll be there for the foreseeable future and beyond even. When it comes into esports, there is beauty in the fact that it's a very open market. And right now there are hundreds of different publishers and developers trying to come up with the next biggest esport. And that creates a lot of competition between them and forces them to always be ahead of the curve, always be creative, always trying to update the game in a way that keeps people engaged. It is not an easy thing to be a publisher, even Epic Games with Fortnite. There'll be a moment in time, probably not too far off in terms of time, that they will have to come up with a different game, or they will need to do something to keep people engaged with Fortnite.
Seems and like the drug companies.
Is that why you have your G2 has 11 different teams? Why you're kind of spread out? It's not just League of Legends. It's not just Counter-Strike. You're in Fortnite. You're in a bunch of others. Just kind of deflecting or protecting yourself against that moment when you wake up and wow, no one's playing PUBG anymore, or no one's playing Fortnite anymore.
Yeah, but first of all, I don't think it happens from one day to another, but other games like Call of Duty Black Ops 4 apparently will get a lot of market share in terms of Battle Royale games, which is what Fortnite is and PUBG is. And you want to be ready for that moment when that happens, or if that happens. Now, I don't think about it defensively. I don't think about it like, oh, this game may die one day. I think about it on the offense. So the majority of our games, so there's four games that are just super large and just safe bets because you know that'll be there from the foreseeable future. But there are games that are just bets that you expect in the next 12 months, the game will pop off and will become a tier one game, super played, super watched. And in a way, we approach this as if it was a portfolio, right? We look at target audiences, for example, Counter-Strike, which is a shooter game. It's very loved by old school esports lovers and supporters, whereas League of Legends is a bit of a younger demographic, whereas Fortnite is an even younger demographic. And then you have games like Hearthstone, which is a card game, is very strategic, not too much dependent on mechanics and reflexes at all. Therefore, a target audience all the way from 26 to 38 years of age is more common to be found in Hearthstone. So this is the way we approach kind of our teams. We want to be able to tap into millennials and post-millennials and even kind of older generations in a conscious way.
We're talking with Carlos Rodriguez, the founder of G2E Sports. Now, I have a serious question, but before I get to that, I have to bring this up. And this is something that happened on Fortnite, and I was there the night it happened with my 13-year-old. Apparently, it was a special night when, I guess, the rocket was going up. And everybody made a pact. Said, we're not going to fight. We're just going to watch the rocket go up. Well, one guy didn't follow that pact.
Started shooting everybody?
Was that you, Bar?
And he got the record for kills on Fortnite. And everybody's like, hey, man, that wasn't
that
fair.
Doesn't count.
I was just going to ask, what do you think about that?
That sounds like something I could do. I could see myself doing that. Everybody just looking at the sky, and I was, that's not what I'm here for.
You got the same mindset as this guy.
Bar, are you as angry as I am, though, with some of these video game makers when your kid comes to you? It's like unfair. Oh, these in-game purchases. Oh, man, it's so unfair. Like,
oh, man.
We got to be the bad people. No, I'm not buying you the skin. I'm sorry, what's a skin? I'm not buying you the wrap, the weapon, the...
For he wanted
$99, $299, $499.
There was a dance he wanted me to pay for. I don't know what
yes.
it was.
But, okay, here's the beauty. When somebody tells you have to spend money on this game, you feel bad. You're like, you don't tell me what to do. I don't spend no money in no game. And all of a sudden, they don't tell you to spend money, but you'll spend on average 200-300 bucks a month just to look slightly better and to have some kind of funky dance. That's so funny.
Oh,
well, did you see the story? What was it, the Times or the Journal, where people are hiring Fortnite tutors?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know you've got good market share, and that's going to be around for a while when people are hiring tutors. You must look at that and say, cha-ching! I love it. And my point with the pharmaceutical companies is they're investing in R&D. Like, not every drug becomes a big seller and makes mm-hmm. money. It's sort of some of your there's research and development going on. Not every game has become a global success.
The vast majority lose money.
There you go.
Only very few break even, and even fewer make any meaningful amount of money. But even if you're in that position, you're not in that position forever. Like, this is what I like about this industry. It always keeps you on your toes. Because as gamers, people that grew with games are used to change and embrace change. Unlike in traditional sports where things don't change as much. I mean, I'm not against it. You know, I still enjoy a lot of traditional sports. But it is true that they're not needing to change too much, right? I mean, the soccer, you saw what they did in soccer with the video thing. The line, the video. Like, it's just so small changes. The game doesn't change at all. And people still freak out. For us gamers, we want that change. We embrace that change. And as a result, publishers are held accountable to change in a meaningful way and remain creative regardless of the success of their game.
Let's talk about valuations for a second. Mm-hmm. Can you say how much G2 is worth right now, enterprise value?
I can't.
Okay.
But you know, the way we look at multiples and things of this nature, looking at NFL is a good starting point in terms of revenue multiples. It's not easy to identify exactly what the value is of esports team because there are so many variables attached to it. Like, how fast is the industry growing? How likely is it that 20 years from now, G2 Esports will still be a top 5 organization on Earth? Well, I say really likely, but
that's a shock.
But you know, there are so many variables mm-hmm. that define kind of your valuation.
There are teams out there that are, you know, valuations that I hear $100 million, $200 million. You know, those are those are numbers that are middling NHL franchise valuations.
Yep.
And when I think about the way NHL teams make money, it's obvious to me. They have a pretty good sized media contract. They sell 10,000 plus tickets a game for their home games. You know, they sell merchandise, etc. Give me a sense of where the revenue comes in for an esports franchise like G2, because the tickets are not, you know, that's not a portion in the same way that it is for NHL.
That's right. So right now, on average, you'll find across the board for top teams, you'll find 40 to 50% of total revenue, sponsorship revenue, below the line sponsorship deals. 25% approximately will be media rights, and 25% were approximately merchandise.
When do you see the media skyrocketing? When do you see the media surpassing? Because that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, so we do see that there is a clear trend in media rights, broadcasting rights, becoming more important for our P&Ls as time goes by. But I don't think it's going to be as crazy as in traditional sports, because when it comes down to merchandise, for example, we have access to something that no traditional sport has, which is digital merchandise. You're talking about skins in Fortnite. What if there's a G2 Esports skin in Fortnite and we get a cut from that, which we will? When that happens, you're having access to a revenue vertical that no other industry has access to. And you're directly monetizing the fan through merchandise, but in their game. And it's infinite, because new games will come in, will become popular, people will buy those skins from G2 Esports in that new game. So if I could explain to you as simply as possible where I see the majority of the difference today in terms of why isn't esports at the level of revenue that NFL is, for example, I see merchandise distribution as being incredibly underdeveloped at the moment in esports. I see fan loyalty payments almost non-existent. Same for ticketing. There is just no team venue. We are actually putting together one of the first team venues open to the public in Berlin, actually. And then we will probably open one in North America very soon. And that's the path, right? But we have not done anything yet. And what I consider also a super incredibly important aspect is that why does a Patriots fan buy a jersey? Well, there are many aspects attached to it, but it's probably because he saw somebody from New York Jets, wearing theirs, right? So you feel that rivalry that fuels the anger from each fan to represent their teams, their favorite teams. And that's something that you can only build through decades of rivalries. And we are not there yet in esports, because esports is not even that old, right? We are talking about 15 years, 17 years old, maybe. So these rivalries, as they develop, and you find, you know, Cloud9 versus G2 Esports so often happening. Fans will find kind of those, that as a great opportunity to represent their teams. And as a result, merchandise revenue will increase exponentially.
So those are things that you guys can learn from or grow out of from traditional sports. Flip it for me for a second. What are things that you look at from an NFL team that an NFL team is doing now that you think, man, that is archaic? We do that already so much better than insert NFL or NBA team here.
Let's overly simplify again. Like it strikes me as incredible, actually, that NFL is decelerating and they're still growing in revenue. Like it strikes me as really incredible, because it just shows their ability to sell their inventory as a whole. Like every single stakeholder has developed an innate ability to oversell their inventory. Whereas in esports, you will see the other side of the coin, where you have a lot of inventory, or you have a lot of great products, an incredible amount of eyeballs, the perfect target audience, but it's under-monetized. So one can teach the other, in each respective area. We can learn a lot in esports about how to monetize that incredible inventory that we have. Whereas sports can learn from us a lot of things related to production, a lot of things related to remaining original and creative and embracing change.
We're talking to the founder of G2 Esports, Carlos Rodriguez. And I hate to sound like Debbie Downer here, but...
Honestly, it just stuns me. Your voice is perfect. It just stuns me.
It's just so unfortunate that he's so ugly.
He had to say it, I mean...
You see what I got to deal with here every week. Gamers were hoping, that was pretty good. Gamers were hoping that esports would be part of the Olympic Games. But there was a survey, it was fairly recently, and they asked about 400 sports industry professionals around 42 countries, is esports an Olympic sport? And the bottom line was about 57% said no. And I guess to get your thoughts, because it takes coordination to do the game. I mean, it's not like, you know, watching Championship Bridge, where it's like, okay, I'm going to hold a card. You have to do something on this controller, and you have to be coordinated to do it.
I had the honor of speaking for the Olympic Committee a few weeks ago on behalf of esports. And it strikes me as really odd that, I'm going to put you an example. They focus sometimes on, okay, it's not really a sport because you don't do anything physically. Well, I can tell you sports within the Olympics that don't require to move your hands in any meaningful way or have incredible reflexes. Then some people will focus on, well, some esports are violent. And not only do I find that ridiculous, because first of all, when I kill you in a game with a weapon, I'm just showing you that I'm faster, more accurate, or smarter, or all three things at the same time, right?
And by the way, we knew that the coyote, when the anvil was dropped on him, that he was going to come back and get the Roadrunner later. So it's like we can pick that up, like what you're saying. It's like, you know, it's like it's not real. So.
Good point. Fantastic. So and on top of that, you have boxing is an actual Olympic sport. So, I mean, I consider that violent, and it's okay, you know? So, in my mind, esports does not need the Olympics to, you know, so to say, become more commercial or mainstream. And this is a bit odd from Olympics' standpoint, which is that, or from people that kind of voted here. Reason is because we are the new people. If you disagree with how the world is moving, then you're disagreeing with progress. And as a result, in the next 20, 30 years, you'll find out that your target audience is disappearing.
I have a feeling that the esports Olympics sport debate is something that's going to be bandied around for a long time now. Yeah. Carlos Rodriguez, owner of G2 Esports, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You can catch G2 competing at the ESL New York event this weekend here in New York City.
Hey, Carlos, while you're here, just take my credit card now. I'm just going to give it to you now.
I'll take credit card. Just give me the credit card.
That's why right. my son doesn't have to ask me anymore. Here, just take it. Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, sir. Takeaways, gentlemen. Esports, I know I say it all the time. Man, there is so much money now in this, and it's going to continue to grow and grow and grow.
Yeah, my takeaway is the sophistication with which Carlos delivered all of the business implications of what's going on. You can picture a guy sitting in front of a young kid sitting in front of a computer screen, and yeah, he's good and he happens to make some money off of this esports. But no, Carlos gets it. He understands what's going on in traditional sports, how they can help esports, the differences between the two. There's a business mind behind all this. That was my takeaway from this. I didn't know much about him before the interview, but I wouldn't bet against him afterward.
Sure, and if you think about the way that, you know, these teams, esports teams, make money versus traditional sports teams, the media rights piece that is so big for NFL and NBA teams isn't really as big for esports teams, and sponsorship takes up a bigger piece of that. And he talked about ways in which you can incorporate your sponsors into the game itself. But as we just discussed earlier in this podcast, a lot of sponsors out there don't know how to determine their ROI. As that space continues to change, it will be imperative for esports to continue to be kind of the front line for sponsors in terms of reaching what is a very targeted and valuable demographic.
Well, those Bar kid right there, his Bar kids, your son, that's who they want to reach. Your kid, my kid, Eben's nephew.
Oscar.
Who's all of 3 weeks old now.
Remember you said you were just going to hand the credit card over?
Yeah. I feel that's the way it's going. I mean, my son has said, Dad, can I just buy? Can I download? Can I just get? And I'm standing firm. The line right now is no, but we'll see.
Does your son have esports teams that he roots for? Or he
no,
just
he
plays
does not.
The
no,
so
yeah,
far?
He just plays the games. He has no allegiance to any specific team.
By the way, I got to say this real quick. You know about Fortnite?
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I love today's life about kids, boys or girls, it doesn't make a difference. They don't care if they're playing as the boy or they're playing as the girl.
Yeah.
That's something that is really
cool.
You mean
the avatar?
Yes, the avatar.
Yeah.
And that is really cool. We have come leaps and bounds, and I am so proud to see that.
Well, I would say yes. My son, by the way, signed up for a cooking class at school, like one of those after school things, and he came home and he said, Dad, I'm the only boy in the class. I said, so, does that bother you? He's like, no, I like doing it. There you go.
I love Jackson.
Yeah, yeah. But he was funny first. He's like, I'm the only boy. I'm like, so? I'm like, cooking's cool. You need to learn how to cook for yourself. So, that's good.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for three in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
Time now for the number of the week. It's an easy one, guys, because we kind of know what it is. 165.
He does this all the time, says it's easy, and I have no idea. Like we don't. Sometimes we talk about it ahead of time.
Characters you get on Twitter?
165. Esports related because of Carlos or no?
Nope. This is not esports.
Laps in the Indianapolis 165.
I know.
No, there's 500 laps in that.
You know what it is. Yeah, I bet you know, I bet you know what it is.
165. Retweets on a cat video.
Oh,
no. Yeah, you had me.
I thought you were going to say 165 lost followers.
I was listening intently. And I'm going to get back to the cat video. I got to tell you something in a second. The 165.
No idea.
Now, first of all, Dana White with UFC says, no, we are not creating a 165-pound weight class.
Oh, Eben, you wanted to talk about this. So maybe in our closings away. Yeah, go.
Yeah, that's perfect. This kind of stems from there's a UFC event in New York City in a couple weeks in early November. As you know, UFC and MMA as a sport fought so hard to get into New York. The first event they had at Madison Square Garden a couple years ago was a huge deal. Now they've got another event on the calendar for November, and because of injuries, et cetera, they don't have a main event. And they are now scrambling to figure out a main event. And one of the options that was being bandied about there, including by the fighters, was creating a 165-pound weight limit as a way to get two very popular fighters to meet kind of in the middle of their classes and fight. As of right now, we're 6 weeks away from a big event in New York City, and UFC does not have a main event. That is something they need to fix, and they need to fix quickly.
How do you fix it?
Ideally,
I mean, you need to fix the biggest stars are who they are, and they're unavailable to fight. How do you fix that?
Yeah, I think you need to find and the outside of this weight class. The weight class could have fixed it. Diaz is a huge star. If you can find someone else to fight him, I think that probably
Nathan Diaz.
Yeah, that probably works well enough to entice people to come out. But you know, there are people that have tickets or are planning to go to this thing right now, and not having a main event is obviously a huge concern.
Yeah, it was a great tweet. Nathan Diaz, he put out a tweet. He said, hey, I'm happy to announce that I'm bringing a new weight division to the UFC. And Dana White says, no, you're not.
Yeah, you don't know if there's
oh, well, maybe that's just like, maybe I'm doing it. I mean, there's some subtlety.
He may
there.
Be trying to leverage his way into doing it by thinking that if you put it out there publicly, that maybe UFC will feel like it has to do it. But there is a disconnect right now between what Dana White is saying, which is no middleweight class and no fight, versus what both the fighters are saying, which is that they're planning to be the main event at 165, which would be a totally new division for UFC.
We are an exciting trio because you've been listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports just like that. We're done. We are here each and every week at the same time, plus online as an Apple podcast. You can catch that Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
Big Barr.
You can follow me on Twitter at Novi_Williams.
And I'm Scott Soschnick. You can follow me on Twitter at Soschnick. Now, thanks for joining us. Please tune in next week when we speak with Barr. This is a good one. IndyCar champion Scott Dixon.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
I know you're excited.
That loud. I didn't mean to say that. I was that thing. I shouldn't be rooting in the press box.
That's all right. Okay. Everybody knows you root for the motorsport.
Okay. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world and online as an Apple podcast on iTunes.